We'll let people join us as they finish digesting and have our friends Kurt and Ron come back up to the dais.
Oh, gracious.
We out of here 10:15.
Ten.
Go before 10, I presume, so we can get to the floor.
We're live? Okay, great. Thanks. We're coming back out of recess. House Ag and House Ag Natural Resources and Rural Communities, actually. And we had just finished a discussion of hunting trends.
Your package.
I did want to let folks know on the committee that in probably late February, I'm planning on having a Hunter's Day here in the committee, where we've asked the organizations, or at least we're getting started on asking the multiple organizations, but we're starting with the Oregon Hunters Association, to come in as a user of the agency and a practitioner of the sport and talk about their opinions of what's going on with the state of the sport. And also opportunity for public comment, because I hunt every year that I get a tag, and I try and go every year, even if I don't draw one in Eastern Oregon, I'll still try and go in Western Oregon. I have very little luck over here, so I have my opinions about it, whether it's my skill, my shooting, the lack of habitat, the lack of available roads to get down. You know, it's a lot of theories. But I want to hear the rest of Oregon's theories on it, too, because I'm not sure mine are right.
We can all bring our pictures
then. Yeah, that's right.
All right.
And I'll bring our pictures. That's to say we don't have to delve into every issue with our theories on what's going on with the trends today, because we'll have a couple hours to think and talk with our friends in the sport in about a month.
Is that fishing and hunting?
Just hunting, that one.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So
just
if we're not hunters, we don't have to come, right?
If you want to vacate your committee seat for the day.
I never even got invited.
Yeah. Mr. Chair?
Yeah.
The last chart you have, age distribution by hunters. In one more year, you're going to have to move over. I'm off the chart.
Chair Flynn, there is something I'd like to point out on that. And for the record, I'm Ron Anglin, Wildlife Division Administrator. You'll notice that there's the peak in the 1991 age distribution and 2007 age distribution. That's all tracked with the same age class that was born in 1959. So they have been the peak of our hunters through time and continue to be that peak, even though we've lost some overall participation, that age class still is the strong one that's carrying through.
Born in 1959. Interesting. Representative Van Orman.
Chair Clem. One of the questions I have, since I live on the Columbia, and the report that came out sort of verified the locals who don't eat the fish in the Columbia, is that an issue, you think, that causes the drop in angling, is the concern about whether or not you can eat the fish?
Chair Clem, Representative Van Orman, in general, no. It's a trend that we're seeing across the country. There's, as you know, demographic shifts to more urban residents and other activities that weren't present 30 years ago, computer games, a whole litany of activities that youth participate in that then leads them to not become anglers. So we don't see the fish consumption issues as a driving force in the decline in angler numbers.
Okay,
would you like to go into the second portion? Or had we finished the first? I think we were had gotten into Q&A, I know, but I didn't know if you were done.
Thank you, Chair Clem. I did want to follow up a little bit on Representative Schaffler's comment, and I mentioned this to him at the break as well, but for the rest of the committee's sake, I know we're not talking about budget here today, but since he brought it up, I wanted to mention this. We did hold 13 public meetings around the state to talk about our agency budget, as well as our external budget advisory committee process that the agency convened. And we heard very loudly from all of our constituents echoing precisely what Representative Schaffler indicated, that they did not and were not interested in having their angling license fees being used for Marine Reserve implementation. So we did hear that loudly from our constituents as well. I wanted to acknowledge that for the sake of the committee.
And it wasn't just Representative Shoffler, all 13 loudly saying it, was it?
But I'm not above doing that.
Yeah, I know.
No.
Thank you.
Okay.
With that then, if there's no further questions, I'd then go briefly into our discussion of strengths, weaknesses, opportunities, and threats, both to the resource, our constituent industries, as well as programs, agency programs. And just this dovetails nicely with Mr. Brown's presentation as well, because some of these threats are the same. In Oregon, just talking off the script here, so to speak, in Oregon, the loss of a working landscape has great and sometimes deleterious effects on fish and wildlife resources. So we recognize that. I'll just let that lead me into my discussion of strengths. We have statewide, we have a very diverse and abundant opportunity for fishing, hunting, and wildlife viewing. We have major marquee species that are huntable in the state. That is certainly a strength in our ability to promote and market these activities. We have a strong professional workforce that's science-based, and very importantly, I mentioned the landscape issues and the working landscape. We have and we work very hard to maintain good relationships with our private land owners and the agricultural interests, as well as the public land managers maintain and work to help fish and wildlife habitat. And we work very hard on those relationships, and that's, I think, from our agency's perspective, one of our real strengths. We have, as you all know, very dedicated constituents. They're dedicated not only in their passion for the resource, but also in their willingness to support the agency and the agency's conservation efforts. As I mentioned earlier, Oregon is not unique. Most fish and wildlife agencies around the country are funded very heavily by fishing and hunting license purchasers. And those constituents are dedicated, passionate, and very engaged. They engage us, they engage the commission, and I know they engage you all on issues that they feel very strongly about. We view that as a real strength. We have extensive public processes that I mentioned earlier, not just in our rulemakings, but we reach out through a number of advisory committees as well as through outreach across the state, locally at the district level as well as statewide. When we worked on our budget, go to great lengths to work with the constituents. We have the Oregon Conservation Strategy, which is really a blueprint for public and private partnerships for developing conservation efforts on a voluntary basis. It's not a regulatory mechanism. It's a strictly voluntary blueprint that we're really starting to get a lot of traction with. We have a lot of people in the agricultural as well as hunting and fishing communities as well as the traditional conservation communities that are engaging with us and supportive of this effort. And be happy, love to come back and talk to the committee about that conservation strategy at some time in the future if you're interested in that. Some of our weaknesses, not unlike other state agencies, funding uncertainty is always an issue. I mentioned the conservation strategy and a lack of broad support, broad funding support for that strategy. Fishing and hunting license purchasers are really driving the agency budget, so to speak, for at least from the state dollar side of the picture. And the conservation efforts on non-game species is really lacking in terms of funding and support for those activities. We have a long list of important conservation questions that really we don't have the information to answer, and lacking the appropriate research and data to answer those questions, it's always a weakness. That doesn't mean we don't proceed. We have to use the best available science, but sometimes what is available is not real good. Law enforcement, our state police trooper levels have really been static over the last 30 years, and while it may seem that hunter and angler numbers are decreasing, so you should need less troopers. The fact of the matter is the people that are violating fish and wildlife laws are not licensed anglers in many cases. So there's this trend. We have far greater population and static coverage in terms of enforcement. On the opportunity side, I did mention the conservation strategy. I mentioned earlier in my discussion about opportunity to create and work with public and private partnerships on promoting fishing, angling, or fishing, hunting, and wildlife viewing opportunities. We've been working with tourism as well as other foundations to do promotional activities. Actually, did it with the Recreational Boating and Fishing Foundation. We've started some direct mail marketing to lapsed anglers. Our new point of sale license system allows us to track our customers better and to look at what their purchasing histories are and target those that have had a license in the past but for whatever reason fallen out of the sport. That all ties in with marketing. In the last session we did receive a limited duration marketing position, which he has hit the ground running and is working very aggressively. I mentioned the direct mail and other campaigns. With regard to threats, clearly loss of habitat is a threat to fish and wildlife resources. Typically speaking, if it's a threat to fish and wildlife resource, it can also be considered a threat to the industries that rely on that resource for their support. So Mr. Brown mentioned the development issues in the working forest being converted to residential or other developments. Those are big issues with regard to habitat. Energy development is an issue we're tracking very closely and working with developers to have smart, sustainable development that manages to meet both the needs of society for renewable, sustainable energy sources, but also maintains the fish and wildlife resources to the great benefit of Oregon's rural economies. Heard discussions of climate change. Climate change has impacts on fish and wildlife. Whatever the change may be, it does have an impact, and these are things that we look at in terms of changing hydrograph. So flows that may be higher in the winter and spring due to more rainfall and less snow, and then lower in the summer and fall due to less snow melt. Those will all are all potential threats to fish and wildlife. Big ticket item participation. We talked about it earlier. Declining trends in angler and hunter participation. Those who are currently funding the agency, that's a big threat for the agency. And just the changing demographics of our society, and which is leading to less interest in the resource and a lost connection to the resources. A long list of invasive species and fish and wildlife diseases. We could go into great detail on those, if you like, as well as social conflicts, issues of a limited resource and how that limited resource is allocated between constituent groups, whether they be archery hunters and rifle hunters or sport and commercial fishers, whatever the case may be. There's a long list of those social conflicts. And I'd wrap up by mentioning some loss of angler and hunter access. So traditional areas where they'd fished or hunted become closed off due to either development or land ownership changes. And a big one for us is the elimination of fishing or hunting opportunities or the loss of management flexibility due to federal listings. So when a species is listed, then suddenly the state government is in a position of having to react and go through the federal processes, and it many times limits our management flexibility to put programs on the ground. With that, I'd conclude and thank the committee again for the opportunity to be here. And Ron, if I've forgotten anything, please chime in.
Questions? Representative Krieger, Hilda Schaffler.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. Regarding bears, my favorite creature, you got a new reporting system. It was it this year or last year? And they had to bring the head into an office. And what have you experienced in that? I've talked to people in Brookings to go to Charleston's a 200-mile round trip. They get it on a weekend. There's no one there. they've got to make arrangements to go to Charleston and take a day of work off. I think you've got to get, if it's still that way, you've got to get something available in Gold Beach or more close to the where the people are, because I think your people just aren't going to report. So I'd like to see what the trend is. Let's say in 2007, 2006, what were the number of bears harvested? And then how many do you think in 2008, and how many reports did you get in 2008?
And I'm going to defer to Ron on that. I know Ron has been tracking that. I don't know if he has all the statistics memorized, Chair Clem, Representative Krieger, but Ron?
Yes, Chair Clem and Representative Krieger. This is the first year of the mandatory reporting, and we are still working out some of the bugs. I know we've had some positions vacant in Gold Beach and not been able to maybe provide the level of service we'd like to down there. We're also exploring options of contracting with local businesses, things like that, where people can bring the bears in and check them in that way. So we're sensitive to that. We knew there'd be some problems this first year, and we're trying to work through all those and make it to where people do not have to take a day off work and go a long distance like that to check in a bear. It's too early to tell what overall harvest is as compared to previous years. We're still compiling that information. Seasons have just completed, and we have the mandatory check that folks were supposed to do, so we'll be real interested in ourselves in comparing that and seeing if there is a decline.
Okay, thank you.
Senator Schaffler.
Thank you. Yeah, this energy as a threat, I would like to hear more from you about that in the future, energy development as a threat, loss of habitat, et cetera. I recognize, you know, certain changes in the air quality or water quality, whether it be carbon or heavy metals in the water, you can measure and quantify that. That's what I want, is measurable, verifiable threats and history of that, not a perceived threat. I'll give you an example, an outright lie, actually. There's more caribou up in Prudhoe Bay now than there was before we started developing those oil fields up there. There's more now than before. Yet you hear people running around saying, oh, the caribou are threatened. It's not true. It's simply not true. Matter of fact, caribou, I think the biggest threat up there is people shooting them for dog meat, to be quite frank with you. And in no way, shape, or form do I think we should take away their ability to do that. I just want to get that. But I think there's a lot of perceived threats, and they're not verifiable. They're not qualifiable. And I hope that those are the threats you're going to address, because I'm interested in pursuing mitigating those threats. And then you do not point out pinnipeds east of the Astoria Bridge is a threat. What is it, 10 fish a day approximately, or if I remember the number right? There's, 500 of them? There's hundreds of thousands of them out in the ocean. They are not threatened. They are not endangered. I think we should, I'll use a politically correct word here, remove them from east of the bridge, all of them. I know you've been working with the federal government on that, and God bless you and good luck on that, but all of them should be removed. So that's my humble opinion. Thank you.
So one thing I'm interested in, either hearing more offline or, if we come back to it on Hunter Day, my personal experience, at least, has been a very large change in the accessibility to roads in the national forest, particularly. But I've had a visit in the interim from folks even talking about private forest land that was once accessible that's no longer accessible. There's a gate across the road, and this is over just outside of Newport. I think this particular person was talking about. So really trying to get a better understanding, is it changes in the ownership of those, on the private side, is it that they're owned now all by out-of-state real estate investment trusts versus a vertically integrated timber company who had mills where their employees liked to hunt, and now there are no more mills owned by those things because the tax laws shifted, so it's just owned by real estate investment trusts, and they have no constituency anymore in the local community saying, why don't you open up the gate and let people go in there on the weekend? Or is it, something else? Is it liability? I know we have bills, or I think we passed a law last time that gave...
You did.
made clear if you're participating in other kinds of conservation programs that you're, but that you, unless you're charging someone to come on your property to hunt, you have liability protection, and so that shouldn't be an issue. But that's very interesting to me. And part of it may involve either if you have someone at your department or bring in someone from the federal government to talk about. Where I go, usually if I get a draw, is in eastern Oregon, and the amount of roads closed, berms plowed and put up, across what used to be campsites for people is enormous. So very limited arteries to travel around to get to a place where then you go out and walk for 5 miles.
Okay. Representative or Chair Clem, we can certainly follow up with you on that either before the full committee or offline. A couple things I wanted to mention, and I don't want to speak for private landowners, but they do face a number of liability issues, both with regard to fire as well as issues that they have of vandalism. You've heard about from Mr. Brown about the difficulty they have making their bottom line, making their property pencil out, and all those factors, vandalism, litter, fire, all contribute to reducing their bottom line, so to speak, and I think that leads to some of the closures. Also, there is a number of them that are working on basically access, fee-based access, and there's one in Representative Gilliam's district, actually the Weyerhaeuser tract there, Malala Tree Farm, is 66,000 acres that is actually now only open to folks who pay for the access. This was the first year they did that. They're looking at every opportunity to extract value from their large timber holdings. It's very common in the southeast and eastern U.S. that companies do that, particularly where they have large contiguous holdings, and it's, as opposed to the ONC lands where there's this patchwork and it's much more difficult to regulate access. So they're looking at ways to keep the landscape a working landscape and to generate income. Fee access is one of those that I think we're going to see more of in the future. The markets are developing.
Representative Wingard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Melcher, I want to understand this because I don't. So I'd like to learn about this. Are people, this Weyerhaeuser property, are people coming on to hunt or to camp? What exactly are they paying a fee to do?
Chair Clem, Representative Wingard, it's a variety of activities, actually. There is some fishable lakes in holding. Some are paying to hunt, I think. And again, they would, I don't want to, I'm being careful not to speak for them, but they have folks that I understand that are literally paying for the membership to go in and hike or ride bicycles or pick mushrooms. They only allow vehicle access on the main roads. They do not allow any off-road vehicles. So it's a very diverse group, as I understand it, that's paying for that activity. Or for the privilege to access that property. And those markets that I mentioned are developing. They're looking at, others are looking at similar things.
Follow-up question. Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, that is interesting. Now, just so that I understand how this works, if somebody comes on the private property to hunt, do they need a tag to hunt? I mean, is that sort of universal across the state, or is there a public-private difference?
Chair Clem, Representative Wingard, they're subject to all the hunting and fishing laws of the state, and they are required to hold whatever license is necessary for the species that they're hunting. So it just happens that they hunt on private property, but they're still subject to all the state laws.
So that I understand this. So how do you know how many fish Weyerhaeuser has in its lake, and if people are getting a fishing license and coming on there and fishing? I mean, I guess I'm wondering what kind of control or what your interface is with a private property owner like that.
Yeah. Chair Clem, Representative Wingard, so in the case that you mentioned, or example you mentioned with fishing on a lake, our lakes are all open under permit regulations, and the commission adopts those regulations. We don't, with rare exception, we don't go in annually and census a lake to know what the population is. It's open under standard regulations. With regard to hunting, we do actually have access to those properties, and many of these landowners do allow us to conduct our census activities there. So we do, in fact, do that on the Weyerhaeuser property, I know, as well.
So when you say a lake is open, you mean by law a lake that exists on Weyerhaeuser property is open to the public? Or are you, I guess I don't understand exactly what that means.
Chair Clem, Representative Wingard, it's open for fishing. That does not mean that you can trespass to get to it. So
if you can parachute in, then it's open for fishing? Is that the idea?
Something like that.
Well, my last question, the one I really wanted to ask before you said something that sparked my interest, was back, and you started to make this point, was on the census. I'm wondering, I assume the department keeps some kind of a census of major species, animals in the state, elk, bear, things like that. And if you do, I'd be interested in seeing, getting a copy of that and what the trend lines are for animals like that.
Sure. Chair Clem, Representative Wingard, we do have annual censuses by wildlife districts. And Ron, if you want to speak directly to that now, we can certainly follow up with that information to you. They're long-term trends you can look at in terms of animal abundance.
That'd be great. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senator Shoffer, did you have something?
No, only to point out, Mr. Chair, that if the state stocks the lake on private land, then the property owner is required to provide access to that resource, correct?
Yeah. Chair Clem, Representative Shoffer, that's correct. We do not generally stock lakes that are on private property unless there's public access.
Any other questions? We're just about out of time. Great. Thank you, gentlemen. I don't know if we had even a sign-out sheet up. Anybody from the audience wish
thank
to
you.
Comment on any of these topics today? I'm going to try and build in public testimony at more than 15 minutes, or more than 2 minutes, I should say, but about 15 minutes at the end of each committee meeting, because routinely, at least, when I watch things, I would disagree with something somebody official and invited said, and I wanted to, you know, give my 2 cents, and I didn't always see that in committee agendas, to just have general comments. I'm going to try and do that each time. If I can build it into the agendas up front, that would be the best way to do it, obviously. Okay. Thank you, everybody.
Thank you.
See you Thursday. Now, we probably are going to end up starting early Thursday, or starting at 8, not 8:30. We're going to amend it, and we probably will drop one topic off because we're getting enough attention already on the different topics. We had the Elliott, we had ethanol, and we had something else, and we probably, with the level of interest, will only end up doing 2. Accommodate the bump of DLCD and then probably do one or the other, but not both of the other 2. Thank you.
Whatever.